Now to the next instalment in our Writers' Room series. Recently on the book show, we heard from Richard Holloway, Scottish writer and author of Between the Monster and the Saint, which covers serious ground from morality and psychology to art and, most centrally, the role and nature of religious belief. 10 years after his controversial resignation as Bishop of Edinburgh, Richard Holloway still has a lot to say about morality and belief systems, as well as his influences, writing style, and his special relationship with his dog Daisy. Today for the book show, he opens his doors to Fiona Kroll, inviting her into his Victorian house and private writer's room in the well-heeled Edinburgh suburb of Merchiston.
We actually acquired this little apartment next door, where my son now lives, and so we slapped a door through, because normally that would be a wall, but we slapped a door through to give me an office, because I used to work at a corner of the living room. I now have a dedicated office study, so let me introduce you to
it. Yeah, take us through to your writer's space.
Yep, yep. It's not an enormous room, but it's adequate for my purposes. We come in, and on the right we have a little area over there where I have standard works of reference, dictionaries, things like that, which I refer to when I'm writing. I have an assortment of stuff in the wall that's important to me. This print here, it's a Scottish loch and an old fishing boat and a wee rowing boat there, and it just calms me. It's a very calming picture. It's by a Scottish artist called Ramsay. And we bought that shortly after we got married. My wife's an American. I met her when I was a student in New York. And she came and joined me in the Gorbals in Glasgow in 1963. And when we were setting up our flat in the tenement that we lived in, she scoured second-hand shops around Glasgow and found a number of paintings and found this, I think, delightful watercolour. And I love it, and I always have it in any study I've had. I've had that.
Looking into many writers' rooms, as I do, it has become apparent that objects of the personal, the past, seem to be so important for so many writers. Blake Morrison, for example, says about his collection of stuff, "I'm not particularly fetishistic, but over time the mementos have piled up. Most of them are inside the glass display cabinet, photos of my primary school class in Yorkshire and of my mother in her graduation robes, an RAF tankard, 2 African carvings, a Communist Party watch, it has never worked, a musical cigar box, I don't smoke, a toothpick holder in the shape of a crocodile, and my father's stethoscope are all in the cabinet." Artworks too are a popular object in many writers' rooms, and in Richard Holloway's neat and orderly writer's space, a watercolour print of a 4-storey Victorian English country house, Kelham Hall, hangs on the wall above his computer and plays a major role in his life, his memories, his makeup.
This print here is of Kelham Hall in Nottinghamshire, near Newark in Nottinghamshire. And from about 1909 to 1973, it was the house of the Society of the Sacred Mission, which was an Anglican religious order where I went as a boy of 14 to train for the priesthood. It's kind of sad for me now because it's now the headquarters of Newark District Council. So it's a kind of Brideheadian moment when I go back and see this place that I went to as a boy that formed me. It's still deep in my subconscious. Is now, and that's my dog wanting in.
Oh, Daisy. Daisy can come in.
Daisy,
hello, Daisy.
Daisy lives beside me. She follows me around.
That's fine.
And this is the River Trent. The architect was Gilbert Scott, who was the architect for St Pancras Station in London. It's kind of red brick, beautiful towers and chimneys and things. I went down there in July this year because I'm going to write something, and I just wandered about with a notebook for 48 hours trying to recall my boyhood, and I'm working slowly on a piece of writing that I'm thinking is a kind of, I don't know, a kind of autobiographical theology, how I ended up in my mind from where I started out, having gone down there as a wee boy of 14.
And do you think that's the place where you perhaps learned or formed how to question things in life. You're a big questioner in your writing. You once quoted the painter Gauguin, who wrote the three big questions on the corner of one of his canvases. Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? You know, you don't seem to be afraid to ask the big questions yourself. Perhaps a reflection of your time at Kelham Hall?
It was that kind of a place. The man who founded the order, a guy called Herbert Kelly, we called him HK. He died in 1950. I was there as a wee boy. And he was actually a bit of a genius, and he wasn't very interested in religion or institutions. He was interested in God, in truth, in challenging everything, in getting people to think. And I think that's certainly what happened to me from Kelham onwards, that you don't just receive official truth uninterrogated. And I guess I spent most of my life interrogating official truth, sometimes unwisely, sometimes, anyway, inevitably. So much came from that place. And so that's why, and a friend of mine who was a priest in this diocese, older than me, who was there, I was, when I went as a boy, he was a man. He was in the final stages of his career there. And he died a few years ago, and his widow gave me this print. So it's a double thing. It reminds me of Norman, but it also recalls those years I spent there. I went at 14. I went to the army at 18 for 2 years, which we had to do. I came back just before my 20th birthday, and then I was there for another 3 years until they sent me to Africa in 1956. So it's a deep, deep bit of my inner life, that place. So I'm glad to have this lovely print.
Around Richard Holloway's space, it is obvious he is a book fiend. I can spot a few of his favourites. The Oxford Book of 20th Century Verse, edited by Philip Larkin. The Nitschke Reader, published by Penguin. The Waves, by Virginia Woolf. His boyhood favourite, Just William. What about other art forms, though? What would the soundtrack to a day in the life of Richard Holloway be?
I wrote Between the Monster and St. Largy to Wagner, but my preferred, and a lot of people think this is a mistreatment of great composers to have them as kind of oral wallpaper. I don't find that, but I'm writing to Mozart at the moment, the piano concertos.
What about one piece of music that you'd have to live with?
Well, a piece of music that's very important to me is Vaughan Williams' settings of George Herbert's Five Mystical Songs. And in particular, I've always loved Love Bade Me Welcome.
Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin.
I've often preached on this poem, or I've often quoted it in a sermon, because there are two versions of the Christian understanding of God. One is of God, the vengeful destroyer, who damns most of us because he's predestined us to damnation. Or there is the God who is unconditional love, who understands brokenheartedly the messes that we get into, the mistakes that we make. And George Herbert's poem, Love Bade Me Welcome, is the best expression I know of that kind of the searching God, like a broken-hearted parent going out into the dark places of the city looking for a lost child. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, ungrateful, ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and smiling did reply, who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat. If that's true, it's a glorious message. I've got one of those chairs on wheels so that I can wheel over here when I keep big box files. Old sermons and lecture notes and things down there, hundreds of them. That's when I use paper if I'm giving a lecture or preaching a sermon or something. And then a series of reference books, a concordance, a kind of theological dictionary, Oxford Companion to English Literature, Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. This I use a lot, the Dictionary of English Synonyms and Antonyms. And one of the things that I do, I always read poetry, and I was down at Kelham this summer. I took with me Larkin's 20th century Oxford verse, you know, it's one of the books I take to a desert island. And I would read a bit of that every day, and bits of it would come out at me, and so I would take a little note in this little black book here. This is for quotes. And what I'll then do is I'll come back and I'll type them into this file that I call quotations for the book. And these are mainly poetry. Here's one, an American poet. I like this particularly. And we are lost in what we are. Our privilege is the unrelenting effort of renewal of sight and hope out of failure, out of impatience, anger, haste, despair, violence to strangers, unkindness to loved ones, disappointment at the failure of expectations that were, at the outset, unreasonable, out of greed, arrogance, and rush. Our privilege is our sorrow, to know by blindness, by falling short, the magnanimity of the world. That chimes in with much of my own experience, because I think that we learn more from our failures, our mistakes, than we do from our necessities, from our successes. I think they are, in many ways, actually quite corrupting. There's a quote here from Milosh. I acquired wisdom. I drink a lot of wine. Truth about others and truth about myself. Often in despair, I ask now why. So what if I was lame and uncertain? Life got fulfilled in a better or worse manner, and a garden of forgiveness gathered all of us. Looking back on my life, I can see how important my mistakes, the ways I went wrong, the denials of difficulty, the hiding of things from myself, and the liberation of actually opening up. This was particularly true of some of my deeper religious explorations when I realized I'd been hiding from a lot of stuff I didn't actually believe in deep down. And it was very liberating to look into that particular abyss and no longer be afraid of it.
And do you think that owning up to your mistakes or, you know, some sort of failure in your past, do you think that comes with gaining more confidence? Is it a confidence thing, a self-confidence belief?
Interesting question. I think it may have to do with a radical desire not to be pretending any longer, particularly to oneself. And to some extent, you can do an official pretense to the world. The world has no right to know what's going on in your own soul. But I think that you mustn't hide from yourself. You must be open to yourself about your weaknesses and needs, but also about the things you're afraid of. And I realized that having been an official religious leader for a very long time, a lot of the stuff I felt I had officially to defend, I think was inappropriate. I mean, I think my problem is not with religion as such. It's with the way religions, faith structure systems, stop the search and package it and say, this now is truth. And you must receive this, you must promise always to obey and believe this. And you cannot do that with a thing as dynamic and changeful as the human mind and its experience of this weird universe. There was a kind of insecurity inside about it, because you're not supposed to say, I doubt that. And it was a bit of a relief actually finally to acknowledge that and to go into the rest of my life in that kind of frame of mind. And the poets taught me more about that, I think, than the theologians. One of the things I've done throughout my life is I've noted what I've been reading so that I can copy it into a commonplace book. And I've got a whole pile of notebooks over here. This is an example of the kind of thing I'll write poetry in. And I like the act of actually writing a poem out or a quote from some other writer. This is mostly poetry, but there is a bit of prose here. Here's a quote from Edmund Burke, Reflections on the French Revolution. Incidentally, I've just finished Hilary Mantel's big book about the French Revolution, Place of Greater Safety, which is devastating. And this is Burke. It is better to cherish virtue and humanity by leaving much to free will, even with some loss to the object, than to attempt to make men mere machines and instruments of a political benevolence. The world on the whole will gain by a liberty without which virtue cannot exist. That's a valid judgment on being too dominated by an idea and not leaving enough space for untidiness.
What do you hope will be written perhaps on your tombstone?
I don't know. He tried not to lie, particularly to himself.
Scottish writer Richard Holloway speaking there in his Edinburgh Writers' Room with Fiona Kroll for The Book Show.